Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, there's a thing that talks around Seattle. Often enough, you can feel it when the crowd gets restless if the event goes to a certain length. You can see the people looking for a chance to exit. One bolts, and sometimes others rush to follow. There was no restlessness at author Alexander Chee's reading on Monday night. Even though the room was a tad warm, no one left. They hardly stirred. Here, Chee discusses his life and work with Seattle-based writer Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. And he reads two pieces from his new book of essays, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. The book is part memoir, part writing guide. His readings are personal, revealing, and poignant. A sort of oral time capsule of cherished, remarkable lives.
Why am I telling this story? I am, as I've said, a minor character, out of place in this narrative. But the major characters of all these stories from the first 10 years of the epidemic have left. The men I wanted to follow into the future are dead. Finding them had made me want to live, and I did. I do. I feel I owe them my survival.
Alexander Chee is an associate professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College. His previous works include the novels Edinburgh and The Queen of the Night. He spoke at Seattle's Hugo House on April 23rd in an event presented by Hugo House and the Elliott Bay Book Company. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature.
In the story Girl, you talk about sort of the power of embodying this identity as a queen, right? And for me, that was a really touching moment, that because I think there's so much hostility, which you talk in the book, obviously, you know, from dominant straight worlds, but also, you know, an internalized shame and femme phobia and hatred of femininity coming from gay and queer worlds, and sort of the embodiment of the queen, you know, as an empowered identity, sort of challenging traditional gender norms and also imagining something else. So sort of what you're talking about that idealization in a certain sense. Would you say that it fits into that?
I think so. I mean, I had a fascination early on with what I considered to be femme beauty, and it was this way in which I could see how the men I desired were attracted to it in women. And so I think that night that I was doing drag, I was pursuing that, you know, to see what was possible there. The drag I did that night was inspired by Tura Sitana and Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, who is like one of the great early Hapa icons, right? Like, but I didn't choose a black-haired wig. I chose a blonde-haired wig. I knew that. But my mother's blonde also. So it was a sort of like, my look that night was some kind of weird melding of my mom in the 60s and Tura Sitana. And I think, you know, the way that I was moving around that night also, and I'll read from the essay in a bit. I realized that there were all these gestures that I knew because I had studied them so closely. The thing that I didn't know that I experienced that night was just how much violence women are always confronted with. And that was the next piece to passing. So like possessing that beauty for a moment, passing, and then instantly being confronted with the possibility of violence. And that was like a moment of going through the looking glass, you know.
Maybe not. Do you want to read from that now?
Sure.
Great.
Hair. The year is 1990. The place is San Francisco, the Castro. It is Halloween night. I'm in my friend John's bathroom. alone in front of the mirror, wearing a black turtleneck and leggings. My face glows back at me from the light of 12 100 watt bulbs. In high school, I learned to do makeup for theater. I did fake mustaches and eyelashes then, bruises, wounds, tattoos. I remember always being tempted then to do what I have just done now, and always stopping, always thinking that I would do it later. This is that day. My face and the makeup I have just applied is a success. My high cheekbones, large slanting eyes, wide mouth, small chin, and rounded jaw have been restrung in base, powder, eyeliner, lipstick, eyebrow pencil. With these tools, I have built another face on top of my own, unrecognizable, and yet I am already adjusting to it. Somehow, I have always known how to put this face together. My hands do not shake, but move with the slow assurance of routine. I am smiling. I pick up the black eyeliner pencil and go to the outer corners of my eyes, drawing slashes there and licking the edges of my fingers. I pull the lines out into sharp black points, the wings of crows, not their feet. I have 9 moles on my face, all obscured by base. I choose one on my upper lip to the right where everyone inserts a beauty mark. I have one already and it feels like a prophecy. I dot it with the pencil. I pick up the lipstick and open my mouth in an O. I've always loved unscrewing lipsticks, and as the shining nub appears, I feel a charge. I apply the color, mauve frost, and then reapply it, and with that, my face shimmers, a white sky, the mole a black planet, the eyes its ringed big sisters. I press my lips down against each other and feel the color spread anywhere it hasn't gone yet. The wig is shoulder-length blonde hair, artificial, Dinelle doll hair, like Barbie's, which is why I chose it. The cap shows how cheap the wig is, so I cut a headband out of a t-shirt sleeve and make it into a fall. The wig I put on last. Without it, you can see my man's hairline, receding faintly into a widow's peak. You can see my dark hair. You can tell I'm not a blonde woman, or a white one, or even a woman. It is a Valkyrie's headpiece, and I gel it into place. The static it generates pulls the hairs out one by one. In an hour, I'll have a faint halo of frizz. Blue sparks will fly from me when I touch people. John knocks on the door. "Girl," he says through the door, "aren't you ready yet?" He's already finished, dressed in a sweater and black miniskirt, his black banged wig tied up with a pink bow. He has highlighted his cheekbones with rouge, which I forego. He's wearing high heels. I have on combat boots. I decided to wear sensible shoes, but John wears fuck-me-pumps, the heels 3 inches high. This is my first time. It is Halloween tonight in the Castro. We are both trying to pass, to be real, only we are imitating very different women. What kind of girl am I? With the wig in place, I understand that it is possible I'm not just in drag as a girl, but as a white girl, or as someone trying to pass as a white girl. "Come in," I yell back. John appears over my shoulder in the mirror, a cheerleader gone wrong, the girl who sits on the back of the rebel's motorcycle. His brows rise all the way up. "Jesus, Mother of God," he says. "Girl, you're beautiful. I don't believe it." "Believe it," I say, looking into his eyes. I tilt my head back and carefully toss my hair over my right shoulder in the way I've seen my younger sister do. I realize I know one more thing about her than I did before. What it feels like to do this and why you would. It's like your own little thunderclap. "Scared of you," John says. "You're flawless." "So are you," I say. "Where's Fred?" Fred is my newest boyfriend, and I've been unsure if I should do this with him, but here we are. "Are you okay?" Fred asks, as if something has gone wrong in the bathroom. "Oh my God, you're beautiful." He steps into the doorway, dazed. He still looks like himself, a skinny white boy with big ears and long eyelashes, his dark hair all of an inch long. He hasn't gotten dressed yet. He is really spellbound, though, in a way he hasn't been before. I have never had this effect on a man, never transfixed him so thoroughly, and I wonder what I might be able to make him do now that I could not do before. "Honey," he says, his voice full of wonder. He walks closer, slowly, his head hung, looking up at me. I feel my smile rise from somewhere old in me, maybe older than me. I know this scene. I have seen this scene 1,000 times and never thought I would be in it. This is the scene where the beautiful girl receives her man's adoration, and now I am that girl. In this moment, the confusion of my whole life has receded. No one will ask me if I am white or Asian. No one will ask me if I am a man or a woman. No one will ask me why I love men. For a moment, I want Fred to stay a man all night. There's nothing brave in this. Any man and woman can walk together in love and unharassed in this country, in this world. And for a moment, I just want to be his overly made-up girlfriend all night. I want him to be my quiet, strong man. I want to hold his hand all night and have it be only that, not political, not dangerous, just that. I want the ancient reassurances, legislated for centuries, by mobs. He puts his arm around me, and I tip my head back. Wow, he says, even up close. Ever kissed a girl? I ask. No, he says, and laughs. Now's your chance, I say. And he leans in, kissing me slowly through his smile. My country. I am half white, half Korean, or to be more specific, Scotch-Irish, Irish-Welsh, Korean, Chinese-Mongolian. It has been a regular topic all of my life, this question of what I am. People will even tell me, like my first San Francisco hairdresser, "Girl, you are mixed, aren't you? But you can pass," he said, as if this was a good thing. He said this as he scrutinized me in the mirror, looking at me, as if I had come in wearing a disguise. "Passes what?" I asked. "White. You look white." When people use the word passing in talking about race, they only ever mean one thing, but I still make them say it. He told me he was Filipino. "You could be one of us," he said, "but you're not." Yes, I could be, but I'm not. I'm used to this feeling. As a child in Korea, living in my grandfather's house, I was not to play in the street by myself. Amerasian children then had no rights, as they usually didn't know who their father was and they could be bought and sold as domestic help or prostitutes or both. No one would check to see if I was any different from the others. "One day everyone will look like you," people say to me all the time. I'm a citizen of a nation that has only ever existed in the future, a nation where nationalism dies of confusion. I cringe whenever someone tells me I am a fine mix, that it worked well. What if it hadn't? After I read Eduardo Galeano's stories in Memory of Fire, I mostly remember the mulatto ex-slaves in Haiti, obliterated when the French recaptured the island, the mestizo Argentinian courtesans, hated both by the white women for daring to put on wigs as fine as theirs, and by the Chilote slaves who think the courtesans put on airs when they do so. Galeano's trilogy is supposed to be a lyric history of the Americas, but it read more like a history of racial mixing. I found in it a pattern for the history of half-breeds hidden in every culture. Historically, we are allowed neither the privileges of the ruling class nor the community of those who are ruled. To each side that disowns us, we represent everything the other does not have. We survive only if we are valued, and we are valued only for strength or beauty, sometimes for intelligence or cunning. As I read those stories of who survives and who does not, I know that I have survived in all these ways, that these are the only ways I have survived so far. This beauty I find when I put on drag then, it is made up of these talismans of power, a balancing act of the self-hatreds of at least two cultures, an act I've engaged in my whole life, here on the fulcrum I make of my face. That night, I want this beauty to last because it seems more powerful than any beauty I've had before. Being pretty like this is stronger than any drug I've ever tried. But in my blonde hair, I ask myself, are you really passing? Or is it just the dark, the night, people seeing what they want to see? Each time I pass that night, it is a victory over these doubts, a hit off the pipe. This hair is all mermaid's gold. And like anyone in a fairy tale, I want it to be real when I wake up.
You have another piece in the book called After Peter, where you describe Peter David Kellerin who was a lover of yours who died of AIDS in 1994. And one of the lines in the book that I think struck me the most is in that essay where you write, "Those of us in my generation who lived in San Francisco had to overcome the false impression that no one like us had ever existed before, because the ones who might have greeted us when we arrived were already dead." And I moved to San Francisco in 1992, so just after you left. But the same, that generational experience, you know, is so much to me how I was formed, you know, as a fag, as a queen, as a queer person, as an activist. And I think often the way that people talk about generations, I think is very false. Often, you know, people will just pick a year and be like, well, you're part of this generation, but I think a generation is really formed by experience. And in this case, you're talking about an experience both of inspiration and instigation, love and intimacy, and also loss, right, and trauma.
But also just like, you know, I remember, so when I first moved to San Francisco, I had a job at this LGBT bookstore, A Different Light. And one of my coworkers, one day, he said, just kind of out of the blue, he said, you know, in the old days, we would have blown each other by now. And I was like, you know, it really was not my context. And then he laughed, and it sort of moved along. But I was like, is he hitting on me? Is he telling me about history? Is it both? You know, it was my first experience of like a what I think of this of as a kind of like. So I've since met many more of them. I was thinking about this the other night when I was in LA for LA Times Festival of Books, and we were celebrating the life of John Retchie, you know, the life and work of John Retchie, who is still alive, and who was presented with a kind of Lifetime Achievement Award by the festival and by the LA Times, the Kirsch Award, and it was given by, it's named for a critic at the paper who had actually ruthlessly savaged his work when he was a young man and first publishing. And the prize was given to him by the son of that critic, who gave him a little kiss on the cheek after he presented it. And you know, and I brought this friend of mine who, you know, he's like a kind of, he's probably never going to have a boyfriend, and I don't really think it's a problem. Sometimes he thinks it is, sometimes he doesn't. He just really likes having sex with guys, but not really having them around, like, all the time. He's not the Marian kind, like, and you know, in the old days he was more the norm, as it were, you know, like, it's not, I don't want to erase the experience of like the couples who existed back then, but I think there was at least a context and a place for what I think of as this kind of like friendly whoredom, you know, where you would have casual sex. You might have casual sex for years in the context of a relationship that was not like a dating relationship. And, you know, it's something that I'm trying to write about now in this adaptation I'm creating with my husband, because I am the Marian kind, of the biography of Newton Arvin, who was a Smith College professor in 1960, who was arrested on gay pornography charges and turned into a sting that swept up like 17 men in the community and ruined the lives of many of them. And the police seized his notebooks, and they went through them for names of people in the community, and they brought them all in for questioning. And he lived like in a kind of obsession with this one man, but he had many sexual partners throughout the area and the community who were swept up in this. And that's the kind of, we've been finding it difficult to portray in a 2 hour feature film, because there really is not a context for how these relationships exist. It seems like scattershot promiscuity, but it's not. It's like something else, you know? And I think that was the thing that we were trying to invent all over again in some ways in San Francisco when I arrived. But we were trying to do it like with the fear of AIDS, with the, you know, the knowledge that at the time that I arrived, there was one drug, didn't work that great for everybody, you know, and a lot of fear.
And I think you conjure that really well in the essay After Peter, you know, where you're simultaneously talking about the lack of these models, and I think you're also creating, would you say, you know, that model through telling his story, right? You ask, you're like, why am I the one to tell this story? You know, I was never at the center of, and you, then you list off different things, you know, communities or activism or where am I now? And then you say, well, I'm telling the story because it hasn't been told, right? And who is going to tell the story if it's never told? And I think it's kind of a similar thing you're saying to this story from 1960, where you're trying to conjure, you know, a life that existed then that was persecuted, that came into the public eye through a kind of sex panic, right? And, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, you know, into the late 90s, really, and then reoccurring all through history, right, from the past into the future, you know, are these sex panics. And that persecution, you know, creates both trauma and also a possibility for identification in a certain sense.
I think that's all right. I think I agree with that. I think there's another context also, which is the prompt for the essay was given to us by Edmund White. He was creating an anthology called Loss Within Loss that appeared in 1999 from the University of Wisconsin Press. And, you know, he asked all of us who were contributing to write about an artist who had died of AIDS and to try to take into consideration, like, what had been lost. And this was in the aftermath of the arrival of the cocktail, which saved so many lives, you know. And so the artist that I chose was someone who, actually, I feel like lover is a strong word for what we were, you know. It was a kind of, I had been, as I'll read from it shortly, but like, he was a crush, basically, more than that. And we went out, we dated for a while. I think, you know, the thing that had struck me about his life and why I wanted to write about him was that he had died just before the arrival of the cocktail. And he had all these aspirations for his life. And in some way, I wanted to memorialize him. So it's kind of a grave song, even as it's also a biographical portrait that's created with a lot of reporting that he did as well.
And I think there's a moment in that piece where you say, you talk about what happens when an artist dies, right? And you say, when an artist dies young, there's always talk of the paintings unpainted, the books unwritten, which points to some imaginary storehouse of undone things and not to the imagination itself, a far richer treasure lost. And I wonder if you want to talk about that imagination that's been lost, and, you know, and whether you think that we, speaking broadly as a culture, have recovered from that loss.
I don't know that we'll ever get to know, you know. I mean, the AIDS crisis is technically, I mean, there's still technically no cure for AIDS, right? Nothing that's like it's a, you know, prep is the first sort of victory our community has had for just pleasure, you know, in a long time. And even that is in the context of it being a drug that not everyone can afford, and availability is thus problematic, and the codes of it are thus also, you know, it becomes a kind of economic privilege to be able to be on it. And so I guess I'm thinking again of, like, you know, just to go back to George Sand, this French woman writer who was able to successfully kind of live out her vision, write her vision down, and influence everybody from, like, the Russian realists to the Brontes to French feminism itself. Like, I think that's what I mean by the imagination that's lost. You know, like there's all the works, certainly, but there's also, like, the vision collectively that the works communicate to the culture, and that is taken up by people maybe who've not even ever read her, you know. But, you know, now she exists for a lot of us outside of France as a kind of caricature, a woman in pants at a bar in a movie, you know, smoking a cigar. But when she did that, women could be arrested for wearing pants. And that context in the movies is often not related, you know. She did that so she could enter men's spaces and do things that men did. And again, that's that. That's what I mean by that imagination, by that vision that's lost. So in a sense, like, we'll never really know what was his.
I wonder if you want to read from that story now. Great.
I'm a minor character in Peter's story. Peter David Kellerin, Peter D. Kellerin, as he liked to appear in print, was a painter. He died in his bed at the age of 33 on the afternoon of May 10th, 1994, at the Maitri Hospice in San Francisco, where he had been admitted after deciding he could no longer care for himself in his apartment at the edge of town. There was a solar eclipse that day, and his passing occurred during it. He had spoken with his mother that morning on the phone. His dementia had parted enough for him to tell her that he loved her. And then he started to go, his friend Laura Lister says. The room was full of women friends of Peter's, and they laid hands on him in a circle. Laura recalls the phone ringing, and she shook her hands off him to answer it. He lunged up off the bed. He went slowly. I begged him to go, begged him to let go at that point. He needed to go. He wouldn't go, though, Laura says. And then one of the male volunteers came in, and he took Peter's hand in his. You could see the change, like a light came over him, and he was gone. All the people there with him at the end, I can never thank them enough. They were all so beautiful, so strong, his mother, Jill Kellerin, says from her home in Chicago. They did what I physically could not do. Peter's death was tearing me apart, and I literally could not be there. They cared for him to the end, and I'll always be grateful to them for that. We were there until he grew cold, Peggy Sue said, a friend who was present. Maitri being a Buddhist place, he lie in state. So we sat with him. I first saw him when I worked at the Castro's, a different light bookstore, a gay and lesbian bookstore that in those days doubled as a reference library and community center. I was 22 years old then. Peter was 28, tall and broad-shouldered and thin. He had a wide Irish frame and usually wore leather, a motorcycle jacket, boots. A dyed blue tuft of hair glowed across his forehead. I'd seen him walking through the Castro, and I'd seen him at demonstrations. A year would pass before I'd hear his voice speaking to me. Our store was the first in the country to have a section devoted entirely to AIDS HIV issues. It was located in the front, beside the cash register. I supposed, the first day I saw Peter, that he'd either seroconverted recently or had recently decided to do something about it. I saw many people in this way on their first few days, and I was forever inventing some story about them, never mentioned to anyone, simply to fill the hours. I was often the first person that they had to deal with after being diagnosed, a bookstore clerk who would show them the short shelf of books, expanding weekly, but still short. That day, he just ran through the books and selected a few on strengthening the immune system, then paid when someone else was at the register. I saw him leave. His blue eyes had a searchlight intensity, and it seemed clear when he saw and what he didn't see. He didn't see me. I felt called and commanded by him immediately, and to this day I cannot say why it was, only that it was immediate and thorough. I was surprised by how much I wanted to be seen by him. That day in the store, after he didn't look at me, he moved quickly back out into the bustling sidewalk, the afternoon sunlight making long, crowded shadows. I didn't know his name or anything about him, except that he was handsome in a way that made me lose my breath, and he was hurrying away, and that he was possibly, probably, positive. In fact, when I first saw Peter, he had been positive for 3 years. He wrote to me from Morocco, Laura says, of a trip he'd taken in 1986. He could only write about how sick he'd been, and after he got back and he tested positive, that was when we figured out that was his onset. He would keep it a secret for years, not telling anyone besides Laura, who kept his secret as well. A lot of people were angry for me for that, she says, but people thinking about your death, that'll put you in the grave. And besides, she adds, if you didn't get your business dealt with when someone dies, that's your own fault. You had every day before then to deal. I was not part of the group that was called when Peter died. I found out 3 months after his death in New York with my friend Corey, who had also moved east by now. We were speaking about our friends back in San Francisco when he said, well, after Peter died, I felt like he'd been cleaning a gun and it emptied into me. Sorry, Corey said. Thought you knew. Hate that when people don't know. When I arrived in San Francisco, there was no way to find the Castro on any map. People were forever calling the bookstore for directions to the neighborhood. In my group, there was a sense that we were a wave arriving on the West Coast from the East, post-collegiate youngsters seeking and finding a paradise of cheap apartments and thrift stores bursting with the old athletic t-shirts and jeans and flannel shirts we all prized. I remember when I put the empty clothes together with the empty apartments on an ordinary sunny afternoon, walking down the sidewalk to work. There in a blanket sit a pair of freshly polished black leather steel-toed boots, 12-hole lace-ups, gleaming in the light of the morning. As I approached them, feeling the pull of the hill, I drew up short to examine the rest of the sidewalk sale. Some old albums, Queen and Sylvester, 3 pairs of jeans, 2 leather wristbands, a box of old t-shirts, a worn watch, the hands still moving. A pressed leather belt, Western style, cowboy boots, the same size as the steel toes. I tried the steel toes on and took a long look at the salesman as I stood up, feeling that they were exactly my size. This man was thin, thin in a way that was immediately familiar, hollowing from the inside out. His skin reddened and his brown eyes looked over me as if lightning might fall on me out of that clear afternoon sky. And I knew then, as I paid $20 for the boots, that they had been recently emptied, that he was watching me walk off in the shoes of the newly dead, and that all this had been happening for some time now. I lived in San Francisco for 2 years, arriving right after I left college in 1989. When I say I was part of a group, I mean I was part of a group of activists who divided our time and energy among a number of organizations and affinity groups. ACT UP and Queer Nation were the seeds of a great deal of what happened there, what happens there to this day. We engaged in direct action protests, spent our free time discussing new protests and the ways in which our past protests had been perceived. We thought about politics and its relationship to our personal lives, to the point the personal was political because that was all there was. We had bitter feuds and disputes. We had angry meetings. We had celebrations. We had vigils and parties, made mistakes and made amends. The average member was 23, HIV negative, white, and college educated, usually gay or lesbian, and from another part of the country. I was 22, HIV negative, Amerasian, college educated, and from another part of the country. Pictures of me at the time show a thin, dark-haired young man who seems inordinately happy for someone who spent a good deal of his time wanting to be dead. They all show me smiling. This young man I was drove a motorcycle, worked at a bookstore, hung out with drag queens who didn't attend meetings of any kind, and was known to dance on a bar or two. He was a member of ACT UP San Francisco before the bitter split of the group, a member of Queer Nation, and an intern at Outlook, a queer academic journal. He was on the media committee of ACT UP and had a reputation at first for dating no one, and then for having dated everyone. He hollowed his desire to die with the knowledge that other people were dying who wanted to live, and this was the single strongest motive for his participation in direct action AIDS activism. Being an activist meant, among other things, never being alone, and being alone was when he got into trouble, and so he made sure he was never alone. Why am I telling this story? I am, as I've said, a minor character, out of place in this narrative, but the major characters of all these stories from the first 10 years of the epidemic have left. The men I wanted to follow into the future are dead. Finding them had made me want to live, and I did. I do. I feel I owe them my survival. The world is not fixed, and the healing is still just past my imagining, though perhaps it is closer than it was. For now, the minor characters are left to introduce themselves and take the story forward. Thank you.
Thanks for streaming this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Alexander Chi is an associate professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College. He spoke at Seattle's Hugo House on April 23rd in an event presented by Hugo House and the Elliott Bay Book Company. You can listen to the full recording on our website, KUOW.org. Tune in again soon.